From WBUR in Boston, it's Weekly Warm-Up, a sampling of the cornucopia of stories and interviews featured on Only a Game, sports public radio style.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.
Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Sunday, under blue skies cooled by intermittent breezes, Johnny Cassolo, a wiry, athletic-looking gentleman who used to sell Hondas, prepares to drive a golf ball off the first tee of the Mount Kisco Country Club in Westchester County, New York. The gallery's encouragement notwithstanding, Johnny Cassolo's tee shot would not be all that impressive, maybe 130 yards out, bouncing into the right rough, except that Johnny Cassolo not only can't see where the ball has gone, he couldn't see it sitting on the tee in front of him before he hit it. Cassolo is one of the 15 golfers competing in the 30th annual Guiding Eyes for the Blind Golf Classic. After Johnny's drive, his coach, Chris Clark, leads him back to their golf cart, where Johnny's guide dog, a black lab named Hallie, waits patiently.
Yeah, she's a great one.
Does she help you out there on the course?
No.
Of course he's going to say that, right?
The dog's a bigger help than the coach is, for sure.
And this is from the coach?
Absolutely.
Okay.
See, when nobody's looking, I have him pick up the ball and drop it in the hole.
In fact, Hallie was just along for the ride. On the golf course, a blind golfer's coach does the guiding. The coach lines the golfer up behind the ball, positions the club head, warns of the water to the left or the sand trap to the right, estimates the distance to the pin, and then stands back and says clear, so the golfer knows it's okay for him to swing. Except that at the Guiding Eyes for the Blind Golf Classic, the golfer isn't always him. Dr. Angela O'Rourke, a retired Army colonel with several blind golf titles to her credit, was among the competitors in Mount Kisco on Sunday, and her dog, Faith, really is a help out on the golf course.
Well, yes, she is, because she's actually a dual dog. Not only is she a guide dog, but she's a seizure dog. So when I have seizures out on the golf course, it helps me clear out of the fog much faster.
How does that work exactly?
Well, you know, I can't explain it other than, like, when I have seizures, it's like the gears aren't completely working correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of hitting each other instead of into the grooves. And when I love on the dog, it's like a shell of protection comes over me.
It's calming.
It's very calming. Where if a human touches me, the fright or the scaredness increases. Mm. But, you know, I just curl the dog. The dog is trained to where if I fall over, she's to come and lay over by me. Or if I call her, she'll come and lay right next to me, and I curl up and cuddle with her. And it just takes that fog out. You know, and it's awesome.
Angela O'Rourke, Johnny Cassolo, and the rest of the blind golfers competing last weekend have all been hitting golf balls they can't see for long enough so that they no longer regard that achievement as awesome. In fact, they take in stride achievements that make playing golf in the dark seem simple. Consider, for example, Bill McMahon, who lost his sight to diabetes more than 20 years ago. I asked him how his health was these days.
It's not good. I had a very serious fall in October 2005, and you know my back is still affected by it. I broke some vertebrae. I broke 8 bones in my wrist. I broke my humerus bone and damaged my rotator cuff on my left side.
And you're still playing golf. I'm impressed.
And I said to the doctor, my first day in the hospital, and he told me that I may never walk again. And I kind of looked where he was talking from, and I said, "You don't know me. I'm not only going to walk, but I'm going to swing a club again." And I think he thought I was nuts, but I did it.
Which is not to say every shot Bill McMahon hits finds its mark. That's a characteristic he shares with, among others, Dick Pomo, who traveled with his wife and coach Sharon from Green Valley, Arizona for Sunday's tournament. On the par 3 eighth hole, Pomo's drive was not all he'd have liked it to be.
Oh, off to the right. Off to the right. How did that happen? Well, we'll have to go down and see where it's at. Well, let's go down and see where you're at, my guy.
Waiting his turn at the tee while Dick Pomo went in search of his drive were Johnny Cassolo and his coach Chris Clark. Coach Clark, with help from Johnny, explained to me that even if Pomo's drive was lost in the woods, it wouldn't be a disaster. The scoring system in this tournament rewards a good hole without penalizing a bad one.
If you make a triple bogey, which is 3 over par, you get 1 point. A double bogey is 2 over par, you get 2 points. A bogey is 1 over, you get 3 points. And then they make a par, 5 points. So you actually, and then a birdie is 8 points. And what that does is it kind of promotes being a little bit more aggressive.
And the other thing, you don't get discouraged. Because, you know, if you're playing in a regular score, you know, you get a hole, you shoot a 10 or a 12 or a 13, which it happens, you know. Here, you pick up, you go home, you know, that's it, you go to the next hole. So it doesn't work on your psyche, you know.
Very little seems to work negatively on the psyches of these golfers. Whereas many golfers, professionals and weekend hackers alike, appear grim as they stride the fairways and have been known to toss their clubs in frustration, the competitors at the Guiding Eyes for the Blind Classic all appeared to be enjoying themselves enormously. I wondered aloud to Dick Pomo, the same guy who doinked that drive into the woods on the right, if maybe everybody seemed so content because last year's tournament was played in cold rain. He didn't think that was the explanation.
We have floated with balls that float and frog gear and scuba equipment. Last year we needed that, but we played. And, you know, you can't be fussy about the weather. If it rains, you play, and if it's sunny, you play.
Well, it's a gorgeous day.
It's beautiful. It takes away some of my excuses.
Well, some of them.
Yeah, I've got more.
Well, you guys are all on an equal footing, though, right?
Yeah, we have to finish before dark for the scorekeeper's sake, not ours.
I'm not sure if they did all finish before dark. I left the course at about 6:30, by which time only two twosomes had holed out. One of them included the eventual winner, 74-year-old Pat Brown of New Orleans, whom I met as his son and coach, Pat Brown III, led the victor off the 18th green once he had concluded his round by draining a 10-foot putt. As Pat Brown III took his dad's arm and helped him to their cart, I complimented Mr. Brown Sr. on the sense of drama he demonstrated with that final putt. He smiled and said he had a great coach. Pat Brown lost his sight when a car swerved into the vehicle in which he was a passenger over 40 years ago. On Sunday, he finished with 37 points, meaning that he'd averaged about 2 over par per hole. Brown has won this tournament 17 times, though he says he's not counting.
No, sir. I'd like to get a number and add one after today, but I don't know what the starting number is. I mean, I got an idea, but let's just see what happens today. What's past is gone, you know.
And what was present on that golf course in the sunshine was almost entirely glorious. Almost, because even on the best of days, golf can be hard work. Sheila Drummond, who lost her sight to diabetes 26 years ago, knows that. When she and her husband and coach Keith, who pride themselves on playing quickly enough so that they're often held up by sighted players, finished their round, Sheila was realistic rather than Pollyannic.
We didn't play great, but, you know, golf is a tough game. It's tough for sighted people. It's even more difficult for blind people and competition. I get nervous. I get scared. You know, I'm not a cool, calm, collected person. Do I need to say any more?
Perhaps she doesn't, but I will. Sheila Drummond was one of the few competitors in Mount Kisco on Sunday who'd never played golf before she lost her sight. She had to learn everything without seeing anything. When she started playing, her husband was skeptical.
You got me going, yeah. We tried to bowl one time together. That didn't work out so well. And she hasn't bowled with me since. And then she wanted to take golf up, and after she started, she says, you know, you ought to do this. I said, oh, no, you don't. If you're doing it in 2 years, I'll give it a shot. And here I am.
And I hope you're enjoying it sometimes.
Some days we enjoy it, some days we don't, and some days we don't even like each other.
In that respect, at least, blind golf is perhaps no different from golf played by a husband and wife who can both see, except that the blind golf played last weekend wasn't just for fun. The 30th annual Guiding Eyes for the Blind Classic raised a lot of money for the organization that has provided Angela O'Rourke with Faith, Johnny Casola with Hallie, and a great many other blind people around the world with the guide dogs who've enriched their lives.
Good looking shot. Good looking shot. You're on the front.
Okay, Mike, around the front. You're near another cart,
so
you have to kind of
go through
a narrow opening.
Regarding my commentary in the June 16th program, Dr. Margaret Duggan, a WBUR listener, wrote, "Thank you for your comments regarding Duke Lacrosse. The young men involved have been painted as the victims for so long, and surely they were victims of a terrible justice system, but the women they hired were surely victims also. Very few people seem concerned with that or with the degrading way the boys treated the women. I cannot imagine how I would feel if my son or daughter felt comfortable treating any other human being like that." In last week's program, Charlie Pierce and I commented, amusingly, I thought, on the way the National Hockey League has slipped from our consciousness. A gentleman who identified himself only as Tim, a former listener, was not amused. He wrote, "I changed channels after being bored to tears today listening to your show. By the way, the NHL draft is going on this weekend, and you blew it. I know you subscribe to the old adage, I destroy what I do not understand, right?" That's an old adage I hadn't heard, actually, but in any case, since what the NHL has done to itself hasn't quite destroyed it, the league probably has nothing to fear from Charlie and me. David Cobb, who hears only a game on Vermont Public Radio, emailed in response to our coverage of the National Football League's conference on head injuries last week. "Helmets have turned a great game into football follies," he wrote. "The old game was played right. Today they overhit with helmets and it shortens careers." I wonder how far back you have to go to find football played without helmets. And finally, Dr. David Warren of Miami, Florida, emailed this week to respond to last week's story about skiing in Dubai. "How sad it is," he wrote, "that with today's energy crisis, global warming, and our youngsters dying nearby, that Dubai has created an indoor black run level ski mountain with throwaway clothes. In summer, in the Northern Hemisphere, there are naturally beautiful places to ski in Chile and Argentina. I volunteer to cover that story if you'll just send me there. Love your show on mostly big people playing mostly children's games." You can send your comments on the program to us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu, but the easiest way to reach us is through the website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Over the past week in Indianapolis, the Poets Laureate of various states met to consider sports poetically. Baseball and basketball, boxing, bowling. No, I don't think bowling poems are where these folks want to go. Anyway, now they'll return to their home states to write poems about what they've witnessed. The result, they hope, will enable their readers to see poetry as part of life rather than part of school. Joining me now from the studios of WFYI in Indianapolis are Indiana's Poet Laureate, Joyce Brinkman. Joyce, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
And Marjorie Wentworth, who is the Poet Laureate of South Carolina. Marjorie, welcome.
Well, great to be here.
Joyce, you came up with the idea for this year's gathering of Poets Laureate. Why did you decide to meld the generally incongruous worlds of poetry and sports?
I guess there were several reasons, Bill, and I did come up with the idea, but the poets did decide that they all wanted to do it, and they were pretty enthusiastic about doing it. One, because, as you just said, we wanted the kids to understand that poetry is not just something that you have in the classroom. It's not something that's boring. That's really part of life, and it's your opportunity to record your observations about life. And so that was one reason for doing it. And we also see some parallels between sports and poetry. From the standpoint of the discipline of both sports and poetry, and as poets, you know, we enjoy playing with words just like people in sports enjoy playing with different kinds of balls and bats and all those fun kind of things. So we really wanted to kind of relay that fun to the kids.
The Poets Laureate were all asked to come to this week's event with some sports poetry in hand, and I understand Marjorie brought a short piece which you can share with us?
Sure thing. You want me to read that now, Bill?
I'm ready.
All right. It's called Skiing. Sliding across the rim of the world, through sun-washed air, past snow-coated evergreens, woods filled with swirling prisms of splintered light caught in ice, endlessly multiplying into silence that flows suddenly inside you.
Boy, that was stunning.
Well, I wanted it to feel like you were skiing. Thank you. Yeah. You don't get to go skiing much in South Carolina, you know.
No, I can imagine not. A work of the imagination, indeed. Now, I'm curious, Joyce, did anybody come to the meeting saying, hey, look, I'm sorry, I tried, but I just can't write poetry about a sport?
Absolutely not, Bill. They all wrote sports poetry before they came, and they were, again, very enthusiastic about it. And my local poets have been working with kids in different sports poetry clinics, like baseball poetry clinic, mm-hmm. and swimming poetry clinics, and all kinds of different sports. And those kids have been writing sports poetry. And we just came back from recording a CD where the laureates have read the poems that they had sent in advance, and some of the kids have read the poems that they wrote in the sports clinics. And so, you know, we just think that's a great opportunity, again, to let those kids be on the stage with the laureates and know that that they have the opportunity to create something that's meaningful.
Mm. One little boy said to me, I feel so special today. Everybody's making me feel special. And that's great. That's how we want them to feel, that they can do this kind of thing.
Have you got a kid's poem you can share with us?
Oh, gosh, Bill, I don't think we brought any of the kids' poems with us. We actually left. When we left, we still had kids back there recording.
Still writing and recording. I probably couldn't stop them.
Yes.
Yeah. But they did quite a variety of things. We had soccer poems, and, of course, we had basketball and baseball. And so we really had quite a variety.
A little bit of everything.
Yeah.
When people think poem about sports, it seems to me they're likely to come up with Casey at the Bat, which if
exactly.
I don't ever hear it again, it'll be okay with me. But my own favorites run more toward Donald Hall describing Ted Williams in the outfield of an old-timers game as a lame truck horse. Did that one come up for discussion?
Actually, we didn't discuss any existing sports poetry per se. We just basically, you know, tried to give them a sports, as far as the kids, give them a sports experience and then help them take that experience and put it into words. You know, when we talked to them about rhyme, they had beach balls or balloons or something like that they were batting back and forth to each other.
Competitive rhyming.
Sort of, yes. A little bit of competitive rhyming.
I like it.
And then whatever sport they were doing. If they were swimming, they would be swimming in the pool, and we would, you know, we would have them listen for the sounds and think about putting sound into their poems. So, you know, we really tried to immerse them in the sport and have them learn something about the sport as well, and then try to put that into a poem.
Is it your best guess that 2 weeks, 6 weeks, a month hence, these kids will still be writing something? Or was this kind of, hey, yeah, we came, we had fun, and then we'll go out and play baseball again?
I think it's like any kind of experience when you're working with a group. You know, not everybody in the group is going to necessarily carry something forward. But I dare say that in each one of these groups, each one of these clinics where one of these local poets wrote with these kids, I think that there are going to be a couple of kids who are going to say, really relate to the writing experience. And it's going to not have just been fun for them, but I think it's going to really help enrich their lives. Another thing is that there have been studies done that show that poetry really helps kids in school. And strangely enough, it doesn't just help you with English. It helps you with math, too. So it's just really, we think poetry is just so important for children.
I'm going to have to take your word for that because it never helped me with math. That was a dead loss. Joyce Brinkman is, in fact, the Poet Laureate of Indiana. Joyce, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much.
And Marjorie Wentworth, Poet Laureate of South Carolina, thank you as well.
All right. Thank you, Bill.
Joining me now to discuss the week's news is Mr. NASCAR himself, the redoubtable Charles P. Pierce, Esquire. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The first two picks in the NBA draft Thursday night offered no shocks. Charlie, at what point in the process were you first surprised?
First of all, I was surprised at the ninth pick when Joakim Noah showed up dressed like somebody from an ice cream company's version of Guys and Dolls. I think things went pretty much in the way people thought. I thought Memphis took a perfectly respectable chance taking Mike Conley as early as they did. Looking up and down the draft, a couple of things surprised me. The first being that if they can keep him off the ganja man, Sean Williams to the New Jersey Nets makes New Jersey a pretty good favorite to at least reach the Eastern Conference Finals next year. I think Williams was the untold treasure in that draft. And number two, for a team that did as well as it did, the Phoenix Suns did very well by their draft day. They got Alonzo Tucker, terrific forward from Wisconsin, and DJ Strawberry, Daryl Strawberry's son, from Maryland, which gives them more flexibility because they seem to want to rid themselves of the perennially unhappy Sean Marion.
Big baseball news this week. Frank Thomas became the 21st player to hit 500 career home runs, and Craig Biggio became the 27th to gather career hit number 3,000. But Biggio's working on another record, too.
Well, first of all, let's deal with Frank Thomas, who celebrated this wonderful milestone in his career by getting thrown out of the game. He was so happy he got run. I think he was just personally going back to take congratulatory phone calls at his locker myself. Yes, Craig Biggio. At 283 times hit by a pitch, only four behind Hall of Famer Huey Jennings, who has held that record for an awfully
long time. I'm not sure what to ask you, Charlie, regarding Chris Benoit, the former professional wrestler who killed his son and his wife over the weekend before killing himself. Since the murder-suicide, several publications have run stories about the number of professional wrestlers who have died young of drug-related causes. Will the Benoit story change the perception of this alleged sport?
I thought so at the moment because I thought this was going to turn into one of those CNN news events that goes on for 3 or 4 months. Now I'm less sure than that. It seems to have fallen off the radar a little bit. There's a lot of reasons why this could have happened, the primary one being that Chris Benoit was just sort of an evil guy. There's certainly steroid talk. There's talk about damage to his brain that may have been done. He seemed to be one of these guys who gloried in getting hit over the head with things. The roid rage argument rings just a tiny bit false to me because these horrible events took place over a considerable amount of time. And as was said of Jean Harris, the famous murderer of the Scarsdale Diet Doctor, you know, she had me till the fifth bullet. I mean, I'll give you roid rage. I'll give you a certain percentage of this. Something else was at work here, too. Unless it gets Congress looking up close and personal to the way the WWE does business, I'm not exactly sure what happens to the WWE, which is already being pressed by the equally violent and somewhat more legitimate Ultimate Fighting Sports.
Charlie, we've discussed the grievance that many disabled former NFL players have against the league for not helping them out. This week, some of those retired players took their case to Congress. Good idea?
Yeah. I mean, it's the only place they're going to get a hearing because NFL management, as witnessed by NFL management's performance in front of Congress, doesn't think there's a problem or thinks the system is working perfectly fine. I think, you know, there are a number of different things that can happen. First of all, the NFL has got to stop being celebrated for the fact it doesn't have guaranteed money, which all the fans think is a wonderful thing, because it creates in that sport a culture of disposability, at the end of which you end up with people like Mike Webster.
Wimbledon has many days yet to run, but already controversy has arisen. Spaghetti costs $25 a plate. Even if you're a player, that's what you pay, and at least one player has spoken out.
Yes, Murat Safin, who's won $13 million in prize money in his career.
That's a lot of spaghetti.
That's a lot of plates of even overpriced spaghetti. He's outraged that people have not gone to the press with the outrage of the $25 plate of spaghetti. I don't know, Murat. You know, go buy yourself a nice box of Chef Boyardee and go back to your hotel room.
Reasonably priced pasta may be out at Wimbledon, but there has been at least one modification of the all-white attire rule.
Yes, lady tennis players can apparently wear red underwear. Tatiana Golovin sowed some confusion by her choice of lingerie. And it's interesting, the Wimbledon spokesman, and I have to do this because it allows me to do my wing commander voice. They were cleared in advance with the referee and in advance with the player. On the basis that they are underwear, they do not have to conform to the predominantly white rule. If they are above the hemline and deemed to be underwear and not shorts. So, let us go here, you and I, and we'll go and spend a great deal of time running our fingers through the lingerie drawer, determining what are knickers and what are not. Pimm's Cup, my lad. Rhodesia.
Thank you, Lord Kirchner.
Thank you, Rhodesia. Heal the blacks within the five principles.
When the U.S. Women's Open got underway on Thursday, it included the youngest golfer ever to compete.
Stop!
And they keep getting younger.
Not again!
What do you think? Is 12 too young to be matching drives and putts with Annika Sorenstam and Lorena Ochoa?
12 is stupid. It's wrong. Don't start this again. Somebody please go to Michelle Wie, now residing at the Jennifer Capriati suite, wherever it is that the athletes who are over the hill by the time they're 20 go. No, stop, i.e.
You know, it's a funny thing about the sport of extreme ironing. It seems that every time you're sure that it can't get more extreme...
It does! Explorer scouts were able to paddle 200 meters along the River Ribble from Edsford Bridge while... Actually, I'm slipping back into the voice again. I'm a good little doggy. Along the River Ribble from the Edisford Bridge while ironing. And they have wonderful pictures of this little guy with a helmet on an ironing board ironing the pants while they go. Very nicely done. Well played.
Well played.
And finally, I've got a Milwaukee story for you, Charlie, and it involves the development of an article of attire that will delight any sports fan who's ever wondered how he or she is supposed to clap for a great play and hold on to a beer at the same time. How do you like the beer pouch hoodie?
As we all know, hoodies have the little thing for your hands to go in when you want to warm them up right in your stomach. They have that, but on top of it, they have a little tiny pouch where all of you marsupial drunkards can put your beer while you applaud. Now, we were going to talk earlier about how Yi Jin Lin, the Chinese star, doesn't want to play in Milwaukee. Yi! Beer-holding hoodies!
Take a look at
this! You don't have that in Shanghai, babe! Well played! Well played, Milwaukee! I'm a good little doggy.
Charlie Pierce, who spent four formative years in Milwaukee, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. I thank you, Charlie.
Well played, old boy.
Thanks for listening to Only a Game. Please check your local listings for the NPR station nearest you to carry our show, and please visit our website, onlyagame.org.